This is John Demetra interviewing Mr. Edward Higgins for Youngstown State University's Oral History Program.
My earliest memories, very two distinct memories, and I don't know the time sequence, which came first and which came second. My first that I can recall was laying on a dining room table. In my house, and the doctor.
I'm sorry.
Was pouring alcohol in my arm, and I remember the pain.
He was pouring alcohol into your arm.
Yeah, it had an abscess. I was struck by an arm. Which I found out later. And I got a fractured skull, and this arm was torn, the left side was torn. That was my first memory, I think. Now, my second memory.
About how old were you then?
I can't tell you. 5, 6 years old, because I do not remember anything of my childhood before that. My younger brother told me that we went to Philadelphia when I was 3 or 4, and he remembers. I don't. My second memory is when we lived up in Washington Avenue and I went to school in St. Rose, which was about 2 miles. I remember crawling home along a curb because the wind was blowing so hard and it was raining so hard, it knocked me down. I had to crawl home along the curb to get in my house.
Holy cow.
And then my only memory, my first memory of school was the third grade. I do not remember first or second grade. That's about it.
Hmm. All right, what was it like in the Depression? Do you remember soup lines or a lot of adults, you know, being unemployed or?
Well, it broke my family up. My father went out to work for people on farms. And he had to stay there. And he worked just for milk and eggs and chickens and things that we'd bring home. We'd see them on the weekends, maybe. And my mother had to go. She finally got a job. I don't know how old I was when she did it, but she got a hold of a job as a scrub woman at Pick-A-High Hotel. And my younger brother and I, when she was working, I'd say I was 11, 12, and my brother is 2 years younger than I am, so he's 9. We did most of the housework. I have 3 brothers and 2 sisters. Yeah, there's 5 years difference between me and the next one. And they were all growing up and they were all doing their own thing and we were left with all the chores. I did the washing, the ironing. Well, he did too. And the scrubbing and everything else.
What did your dad do before he had to go out and work on the farms?
He was a puddler, steel mill.
Puddler? What's a puddler do?
Well, puddler worked in, I suppose, an opener. And he took the slag off the top of the molding mill. And he was making $120 a day.
A day?
In 1928.
That's pretty good money for that, wasn't it?
A lot of people made a lot of money before the Depression. They were making good money like they are now.
Went to Girard High School?
Yeah.
You have any memories of going to Girard? Maybe like your first car? Or?
My first car I got when I was married, after I'd been married for a year and a half, at least.
You didn't need a car before that, or?
I couldn't afford a car before that. And to get around, you know, to do the necessary things, you didn't really need it. We had bus transportation. Very good bus transportation.
Hmm. What was Youngstown and Girard like back then? You know, I hear a lot of people say how busy it was.
Oh, well.
Like the downtown area was really bustling.
You go downtown Youngstown, 12 o'clock at night, see more people at 12 o'clock at night than you see down there at noon today. And we didn't walk around fighting. Nobody was afraid of anything. Girard was the same way. It was a bustling town.
A lot of people involved in the steel industry in Girard?
They had the tannery, and they had a steel plant, I don't know whether you consider it in Girard, called Enbridge, American Bridge and Iron. They had a steel mill. That was the last mill my father worked at, as far as I know. And after the Wall Street crash, from what I can understand, they just packed that steel mill up. Took it right off the concrete foundations and moved it.
Wow.
And my father was out of a job. And of course he tried everything. Went down to Pittsburgh, tried to get to work there and got it and last for 5 or 6 weeks or 3 or 4 months, something like that. And then they closed down. Then they go up to the lake and try to work on the fishing boats. And finally it got so that they were throwing, there were too many men and not enough jobs. So he ended up doing what he did. Hmm. And a guy by the name Hitler gave him a buddy job.
Did you serve in the military before you got on the railroad?
No, I hired out on the railroad the day I graduated from high school.
How did that come about? Why the Erie Railroad? Why the railroad?
Well, my brother Tommy, the oldest brother, had worked for that railroad in the engineering department.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a connection. That's how they hired. They hired family, or knew somebody. So, I couldn't think of anything else to do. Just waiting to get drafted anyway, or called up. I hired out in Erie Railroad, May 31st, 1943.
Do you remember like the steam engines back then?
Oh yeah. The steam engines were still being used in 1943. Diesel came in after the war.
Okay, you hired out as a clerk?
Yeah.
And you wouldn't have really had much occasion to be on the steam locomotives then, right?
No.
Okay. What was your first clerical job? Where at?
Extra yard clerk.
At Briar Hill?
No. Answer the phone. They had 3 yards in the Youngstown area. NK Yard, which is down near Hazen.
Okay.
Briar Hill and Home Street, which is where the terminal was down there. Home Street was the former name of Fifth Avenue.
Oh yeah?
Yeah.
Home Street.
Remember the bridge? Remember the Consolidated Warehouse on the other side?
Yeah.
Okay, that was called Home Street.
H-O-M-E?
H-O-L-M-E-S.
Oh, Home Street. Was the yard down there pretty big?
There was passenger station, and also stored cars there for Consolidated Warehouse and the other industries, the little warehouses and various industries they had downtown.
Okay.
And also we had our freight house there.
Did you work in the freight house?
Yeah.
So you're just pretty much on call wherever they need you then?
When I first hired out, everybody was there.
Yeah.
Everybody that hired out wherever those days, you answered the call. And if you didn't take the call, you didn't work anymore.
They wouldn't call again?
No.
Okay. You started off as extra. How did you end up getting into yard mastering?
Well, let me see. Went to the merchant marine.
Oh.
6 months. Not even May. I went in the merchant marine sometime in the winter.
Why'd you do that?
Patriotism. Everybody that I went to high school with was either joining up or being drafted, and I knew I was going to get called anyway, so I thought I'd try the merchant marine. Okay. And I didn't like the merchant marine, so I quit.
Did you make any trips with them?
No. All I did was go to school and shoot some payload.
What didn't you like about that?
Well, to begin with, they lied to me. They told me when I went in, I went in to study to be, I went to school to be a fireman on a ship.
Okay.
Okay, I went to school for about, I'd say 2 months, learning that and other various seamen. I had to learn to be a seaman, too. And then when it came time to graduate, they wanted to ship me out as a messman. So I just told them no, I quit. It wasn't actually military service.
So you still could quit?
Oh, yeah. So I quit there and come back to work. And then, and I think it was about 7 months later I was drafted. And when I went to Cleveland, they asked me which I went with a friend of mine that I went to school with. They asked me which service I wanted. I asked for the Marine Corps.
Why did that?
I don't. Because he wanted to go to the Marine Corps too, I suppose. We went to boot camp together. I never saw him again after that. Well, anyway, after I came back, I had to back out, I think, in 46. November 46.
Discharged, yeah. November 46?
Yeah. So I went in January 45, so it was almost 2 years.
Okay. Did you go overseas in the Marine Corps?
Yeah, I was in the Central Pacific and I was in China.
Was that interesting? Anything you have memorable about that?
Well, I really can't say too much about the Marine Corps, per se, about what I did in the Marine Corps, except to tell you I did a lot of things in the Marine Corps. I drove truck, I was an MP, I was a mailman in China. Just all around everything. Did everything anybody asked. Which is not.
But I, China was the experience that I'll never forget. I saw that and I couldn't imagine why people put up with such shit. Those people put up.
Like what?
Poverty. People in the United States really don't know what poverty is until they see how people in other countries live. One side of the street you've got people who are millionaires, and the other side of the street you've got a million people doing everything but eating each other to stay alive. And what really got me, I suppose, is those people took it. And I couldn't understand why. Then I found out later they've been taking it for 2,000 years, they were used to it. And as far as us being over there, I thought it was stupid. It was very dangerous because that was the time that the communists and the nationalists were fighting. We were over there supposed to protect Americans. But they gave us rifles and guns and everything. No ammunition for it.
No ammunition?
No ammunition. One of my last jobs was driving between Shenzhen and a town called Qinglongtao with mail and military correspondence and so on and so forth. Back and forth, it was about a 75-mile-an-hour trip one way across a desert by myself. And that's what I did 3 times a week, going there one day. It took a day to get there, the roads were so bad, you didn't have another day to get there.
Hmm. Never break down?
No, thank God. And then I got discharged, and I came back. And I took, I had a month's leave coming to me, so I took it. And then only as it was up, I went back to work on the railroad again.
They held their job for you?
Yeah, well, they had to. Congress had passed a law by then making employers do it, because employers, when they first started coming back after VE Day, employers didn't want to hire them back. They already had employees. And Congress then passed the law making them.
What do you think about the atomic bombs on Japan?
Well, they say it would save a lot of lives, not a save mine. But it sure opened a whole can of worms that we're going to be sorry. That's all I can say. I'd rather they hadn't discovered it.
Come back to Youngstown area and working for the Erie Railroad as a clerk still?
Yeah.
Okay. What kind of jobs are you doing then?
OCR. And then I got married. And I was going to school.
At Youngstown?
I took advantage of the GI Bill of Rights. I was going to school to study to be an accountant. And, I got married in 1948, and I was working part-time in the railroad, going to school, and then my father, we were living in an apartment, my father talked me into building a house. So I was building a house, going to school, working, and we had a new baby then. And it was just too much for me. So I had to give up some. And by that time, I had been, in 1949-50, I was working on call as an extra yard master. so I gave up school. Then in 1951, I was made a full-time nurse. And I had to fight to get that.
Why is that?
Well, there was an older man who was night general yard master. And he hadn't been made yard master until he was 40 years old. Well, in 1951, I was 25 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought I was too young to be yard master. And he told me, the man was honest. And I cornered him and I asked him why he put the kibosh on me. Because when you got promoted to yard master, the superintendent called you and talked to you. He invited me to my house to meet his wife, to see how he got along with the company. And they also asked the other officials what they thought of. And he was the only one that thought I shouldn't become a yard master. So I asked him why, and he told me, I think you're too young. I said, what do I have to do? Be 65 before I become a yard master. He said, I was 40 before and they made me one. I said, what's that got to do with me? And then he thought about it for a while, and he says, you're right. And he put in a good word for me, and I was made yard master.
They wanted to see how you acted in company and all?
Yep. They do it with all officials. Didn't know that, did you?
No.
Every corporation does.
Any regrets about going into yard mastering instead of school?
No, not really. I love railroading. I really like railroading, and I love working for the Erie Railroad. I really did it. For me, it was a fun work. Because it was the same, but every day was different. It seemed like it wasn't. You went out and you switched cars and you did that. It looked, on the surface, it looked like everything was the same every day of the week. But it wasn't. You can never tell what's going to happen in the world. And I enjoyed it until we became the Conrad.
Okay. We're getting to that. Okay, so it's like early 1950 or 51 we made a full-time
1951,
yard master?
1951, yeah. Okay. That's when I became, that's also the year that the railroad yard master became unionized.
What'd you think about that?
I thought it was a good deal. Because when I hired out, I was working 7 days a week.
As a clerk?
As a clerk. Also, they were working 7 days a week as the yard master. One of the first things they did when we became unionized was they got 1 day a week off. Now, since 1951 up until 1970 when I came back from Chicago, I never worked 5 days a week. It was 6-7. 24 hours a day. Because in 1960 I got promoted again. And the reason I took the promotion.
To what?
General Yard Master in Lovettsville. And the major reason I took it is because it was a time it was a steel strike. And business overall, generally in the country, was down. And in 1960, I didn't have enough seniority to hold a yard master's job. They were cutting yard masters. And I had just barely enough seniority to hold on as an extra inspector. Well, they promoted me to general yard master, and I took it. That's one of the reasons I took it.
Is that a supervisory job?
Yeah. And my first general yard master job was in Longsburg on that.
Was that a busy place?
Then Lovettsburg was very, very busy, very busy. Of course, when I went there, like I said, steel was down. In fact, my first, when I got the job, July the 1st, my first action after I became a yard master was knock off 3 jobs because there was not enough business for them. But the job, my territory was from Lovettsburg, Ohio to Cortland, Ohio. And along what we call Northmore, he had Thomas Steele. He had Taylor Winfield, Copperwell Steele, Ohio Light, Packard Electric, Heltzel, Wien Engineering, Mullins Manufacturing. There was a small plant, approximately every half a mile on both sides of the tracks, from about Lovettsburg, Ohio, to where the Packard Electric plant is now, up almost in the corner, on both sides of the track. Little manufacturing firms, machine industries. Wien was big at that time, very big. Taylor Winfield was. Mullins Manufacturing was very large then. When business picked up, the crews, of course, went back on. But we switched the firms. We had crews there around the clock, switching all these old firms. Right now, the hot deal is nothing except that.
Did you enjoy that job?
Yeah. It was a challenge. It was something new.
Was that the kind of job where you were on call 24 hours?
Yeah.
Okay. How long did you do that?
1 year. Then I went to Kenilworth. I was the general yard master. And then I started at Kent, outside of a new industrial switching. The only thing I did there, we handled mainline trains. That was my first experience with mainline trains. See, everything was a different experience. At Briar Hill, and I also worked in the passenger depot in Youngstown while I was around here. I enjoyed that a lot. That was fun. Anyway, I had passenger train experience. Youngstown at the depot. I had major industrial switching experience at Briar Hill with the shooting tube and the Howards and the big mills, ore and all that stuff and coal. Then at Lovettsburg I had industrial switching and handling crews around the clock for 24 hours. And also I had the responsibility and the authority to go with it for approximately 35 mile railroad. And I enjoyed it. And then when I went to Kent, I got into handling mainline trains, which I had no experience in because Briar Hill was off the main line. Our main line ran through Cortland, North Warren, out of Meadville, into Kent, and then on to Marion. Yeah, I was there at Kent for a year.
Did you move to Kent?
I moved to Ravenna. I moved from Youngstown to Champion when I got the job at Lovettsburg. When I got the job at Kent, I moved to Ravenna, which is only 4 or 5 miles from Kent. And I was in Canada a year and they wanted me to Chicago. Take me back here.
As a general yardmaster?
Yeah.
How'd you like it out there?
Well, it was an entirely different world. In all the other places I've worked on the river, everybody got along. I don't mean all the time. But there was no man against management or man against boss, per se, around Youngstown or Kent or anything in this part of where I worked before. Going out to Chicago was like moving into hostile territory. It was strictly adversary. I don't know. I can't really explain it. They just didn't like authority for some reason, of any kind. They didn't even like their own union bosses. They kept changing them every 6 months. They'd be in one union, then they'd be in another union, then they'd go back. Oh, God. But I enjoyed, it's another phase of work, I enjoyed the piggyback operation. And they had quite a piggyback operation out in Chicago. It was the biggest one in the town. Of course, it lost money, but it was still the biggest one in the town.
How long were you out there?
6 years. And I gave it up. And I quit. I resigned because at that time, I'd say this was in 68. While I was at Kent, we became part of the Erie and the Lackawanna merged, or became one railroad. Well, that was two dying railroads.
The Erie was dying at that time?
Well, the Erie Railroad was in bankruptcy from the day I hired out until the day it no longer became. Erie Railroad went into bankruptcy sometime during the Depression. Never got out of it. Not even during the war. When times were good, they never got out of it. Then the Lackawanna was going bankruptcy, so then they merged, which made, over a period of time, they made some bad decisions as far as the piggyback operation was concerned. And then the NNW started nosing around because they wanted a gateway to Buffalo and they wanted a gateway to New York. So they formed an outfit, I don't even know if you can recall, it's called Derrico. And the NNW took over the operation of the Erie Railroad. That lasted for about, oh, I don't know, 1970, 71, when they started talking about Conrail. But I quit because everybody was frightened.
Frightened of what?
Losing their job. And I was a protected employee. I could always go back to my yard and stuff. They could too, but they didn't want to. But I was working too long, doing too much. Didn't even give me any help. I don't know whether you heard of the big snow in Chicago or not.
What
happened in oh, either late 68 or early 69. went to work. I lived 25 miles away from where I worked, and the lines are running low. When I went to work one morning, it started snowing, really light snow. At noon, the snow was up the windowsill in the yard office, the bottom sill. Didn't stop snowing another day in a row. At noon, this another thing. At noon, when the snow got up to there, I started to call Cleveland, which was the operating headquarters, and told them to stop all trains coming to Chicago because it was snowing and there was no way that we could take the trains in the piggyback yard, 51st Street yard. They wouldn't believe me because it was snowing in Cleveland. Well, it kept on snowing, and at 3 o'clock that afternoon, I shut 51st Street yard down. I had to, because I didn't have enough men to clean the switches. The railroad over which we traveled was not the Erie River. We traveled from Hammond to Chicago in the CMWI. They were tied up. We had piggyback trains loaded nose to nose, sitting between 51st Street and Hammond, Indiana. I had them come up behind each other, pull the slack out, drain the engine, shut them down, and tried to get them in by cab. So I had them lined up from east end of 51st Street yard to 157th Street. Before they finally shut them off. The only thing that was kept open was the track coming up by the yard office going into the engine house. I had a crew around the clock. I had to keep the crews there. They couldn't go home anyway. All they did was run the engine up and down that track for 2.5 days. So it puts down. The whole city was paralyzed. And the crowning blow was, I'm here for 3.5 days, they finally got the big snowblower from the DLNW, and they borrowed snowblowers from the UP and the other railroads, and they got them in, they started blowing snow. The railroads out in Chicago are all built over the streets until you get near downtown. And they're going to the club, and they're going to the streets. They had no place to put snow. So they had to put in their mills and ship it out. Well, when first I left work, I mean, 3.5 days after I got there, go home after we had finally taken in two of the piggyback trains. We were the first railroad to open up in the city of Chicago, piggyback yard as far as I know. When they started pulling the first trains in, I got in my car and started home. 25 miles away from the 8 hours. I drove through black backyards, down railroad tracks, across unfinished highways, through towns that I'd never been for before in my life. And in fact, there was one point I'm going along and I said, boy, I'm following this traffic, and the traffic is going real good. I'm following, all of a sudden it stops. It was something up ahead. I had the facts up 2.5 miles. drive it back and try to do it in a while. Anyway, I did it. So I got home. I left work about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, home about midnight or 1 o'clock. And I told my wife to call me at 6 o'clock in the morning. I said, I'm going to work. She didn't call. She let me sleep until about noon, until I woke up. So I woke up, I got dressed, and I went back to work. It took me about 3 hours. They had some of the express lifts. I didn't mind them. Took me about 2 hours, 2.5 to get to work. And when I got to work, the superintendent was there then. We wasn't there for 2.5 days because we couldn't get there. We don't know where the hell I'd been. Four months later, I resigned and made to get back as right master. But I had exercise my support. They were afraid of losing their jobs because, I don't know, merger climates on in a business really upset the morale of everybody. From the janitor right up to the president in charge of the operation. And nobody knew what was going to happen. So they were all afraid. Afraid to make a mistake. And when you're afraid to make a mistake, you don't do it. And I didn't like it. I didn't like the feeling of being around people who were afraid. So I came back to it. As the art master. Same thing happened to Harry Joyce. I think you got fed up with him. Because Harry was out there maybe a year before I was. But he didn't like it. Did he tell you about Chicago?
He told me about a few things out there. It wasn't pleasant for him.
Oh, no, it's not pleasant. Hey, I'll tell you, we had one guy, and this is the honest of God's truth, the way I could tell where he was at was there was smoke. No matter where he was in the yard, if you were looking for him, all you had to do was look for a little column of smoke. No matter where that man was, he was standing still, he started the fire. And then there was one other time, I'm here, I've been here about 6 months. And I'm sitting at the table, my desk, and I feel this cold in the back of my neck. And I turn my head a little bit, and there's a character with a shotgun up against the back of my neck. I said, what the hell are you doing with that thing? He says, I thought maybe I'd scare you a little bit. He thought it was funny. And this stupid shotgun was loaded. And right in the middle of 51st Street Yard, across from the yard office, there was a grain elevator, not operated by the irrigator. Was just there. Well, the foreman of the grain elevator was a real drinker. And he'd drink to the point where he loses mind, you know. He's not staggering drunk, he walked, you'd never know he was drunk, but he'd go crazy. One morning, I'd never met him. I didn't know this. I found out it was, you know, that way after he came through the door of the office with a crowbar in his hand. He was looking for me. I had never seen the man before in my life. Didn't know who the hell he was. He is going to crown me with that crowbar. And he had no idea why. After they grabbed him and held him down, and calmed him down, he finally explained to me why he was so mad. In our refueling station. There was a little tank where they had fluorine, which they used in the bleaching process in the grain elevator. They had parked the engines on the adjacent track so that this man couldn't get in there to open up the fluorine and let it go over the grain elevator. So instead of coming, you know, and asking me to move the engine, he just blew his mind and it happened with that throw bar. He thought I'd done it on purpose. I didn't even know the fluorine tank was there. And that's only a few of the things. And they went on strike every 6 months out there. I tried to cut down the overtime. After I got there and I learned the operation a little bit, I tried to cut down the overtime. They went on strike. I saw more of my old buddies out in Chicago than I saw in all the other towns. All the foremen, Walter Coleman, all the trainmasters, they were all out there switching cars. About every 6 months they went on strike. Got sick, no matter what.
I can see why you get fed up with that.
Well, the thing is, all it, the company kept caving into them because they didn't want to, they were still in this merger thing, so they didn't want to do anything. So they ended up caving in. I remember one day out there, Super Dan came in to me, and he got a phone call from Cleveland. They were complaining about the dinner hour on the outlying groups. In Chicago, I say the piggyback operation we delivered hot merchandise, first class merchandise, you know, newsprint, so on and so forth, the road to by the railroads by direct delivery. Well, all those, the men, they were never on our railroad to begin with. And even the 51st Street Yard was on the CMWI railroad. The minute they got out of 51st Street Yard, they started and went to these other railroads. They were on other railroads, sometimes two or three, before they got to where they were going. So you had no idea what was. They've been doing it for years. There was no way to prove it. You ask them, well, the yard master here, or the superintendent there, or the switch tender here wouldn't let me stay there. So I had to keep on moving, so I had to work through my dinner. Okay, according to the rules, you got paid an hour for it. Well, the superintendent came in and told me he got a phone call from Cleveland. They wanted it. You know, our cutout right now. Yeah, what you doing? I said, you sure? He said, yeah. I says, okay. So I turned around and I says, got everybody on the time slips. And I got on the phone and I called Cleveland, Ohio, and I says, send train masters and road foreman vengeance and anybody you could spare out to Chicago, because they says, we're going to be sick. 3 o'clock that afternoon, when the caller started calling the crews, everybody is sick. Two days later, everybody's back to work. Dinner hours for them. And I just got tired. So I come back here. And I enjoyed myself and took on nothing.
When did you come back?
69. I think in May, something like that.
Okay. When did you return?
82.
82.
On a disability in June. June the 6th, I think, was the last 82, was the last day ever.
That was a good time for you on the railroad? Back in Youngstown yardmastering?
Oh, yeah, I was back amongst friends again. Until it became Conrail, and everybody started getting frightened again. And the transition between Conrail and between Conrail and the Penn Central and the D&H and whatever railroads became part of it. It was all over the system. Everybody was afraid of their job. And they were afraid of what was going to happen. Now, I mean everybody, from presidents right on down. And of course, you know what happened. The presidents of the Erie and all the, they lost their jobs. They had reason to be afraid because, I don't know how many people were working for the five railroads before Conrail. I'd imagine something like 50,000, 60,000 people.
I heard over 100,000.
Well, maybe it was as high as 150 because, come to think of it, they had 100,000 working for the Penn Center. I'd say 200,000 people. How many's working for Conrail today?
25,000.
Yeah, 25,000 people. The thing I liked about, loved about Conrail was when they brought out they had more inspectors operations on that railroad when they were becoming Conrail than I ever saw in my life. And everybody thought they were going to get promoted. You know, more people with the pencils. The minute they became Conrail, those people got jobs.
Did you ever run across any famous people in your career? Like whether they be celebrities or railroad presidents or chairmen? Or
I met Averell Harriman once.
Oh yeah?
Just to say hello to him, say Mr. Harriman. He was in the business car. He was in the business car downtown. That's really deep.
In Youngstown?
Yeah. He was chairman of, I don't know, I don't think it was, I think it was his father I met. Because he was chairman of the board of the UP. He was going to New York for a board of directors meeting or something. And outside of that, the only other notable thing outside of derailments, which I had a few, more than a few, and handling atomic waste, which if I'd have known then what I know now, would never came into Youngstown Depot. And the people of Youngstown would let them, but came right up to downtown Youngstown, right in the middle.
What was that, the stuff from Three Mile Island?
No, atomic waste from these plutonium factories and making atom bombs. It was not low-level waste. It was high-level waste going to Hanford, Washington. And this was in the 50s. And they'd bring a train about 2 times a week. And they changed crews in Youngstown.
Right through downtown?
Yeah, well, the Erie Terminal, Commerce Street, downtown. There's no railroad there anymore. They took it up. They're going to be sorry they did, but they took it up.
Did you ever, what was your experience with, say, substance abuse on the railroad?
Well, when I was on the railroad, most of the time, the only substance abuse, and there was quite a bit of it, and in the early days, it was not frowned upon too much. As long as you didn't get hurt or get anybody in trouble or get in trouble yourself, that was drinking. Now, when I came back and we started to become Conroe, marijuana, and I suppose a little cocaine, I'm not sure, but marijuana very definitely, and drinking doubles. Now, how it was, how it is now, I have no idea. It's been, I don't suppose it's any better.
It was a problem, though?
With the older people, I hate to make these distinctions, but the older people from the Erie, they had calmed down. They learned their lesson, because I can recall when I first became yard master, one of my major problems was people coming to work drunk or getting drunk while they were working. I wouldn't put up. I sent them home. I wouldn't let anybody that even remotely looked like he was going to hurt himself or anybody else go on that leave. And then the other yard masters, they were starting to get young like me too, and they started doing the same thing, they wouldn't let them. So it calmed down all the way, because it was still being done. But it wasn't as much or as overtly as it had been when I hired out. Of course, I hired out in 1943, and we're talking 10, 11, 12 years later. But I didn't notice marijuana smoking until I got Penn Central people on the road. I hate to say it, but that's it.
Okay.
And I also know of officials, they are no longer officials, that smoke marijuana. What else they did? Cocaine, I really couldn't tell you about cocaine, because I've never seen it. And I don't go to places that I know that it's being sold, that I know.
Okay. What do you think? Do you think there's a future in railroading? You know, people never thought that the passenger traffic would decline as it did.
Well, we can blame General Motors for decline in passenger trains, trolley service, and bus service, and the federal government. But they're going to have to come back to railroads sooner or later, because too many automobiles, too much pollution, and it's going to cost too much money pretty soon, next 10 to 15 years to operate an automobile. So you're going to have mass transportation, you're going to have short-haul trains again, because the air won't stand.
What do you think the impact of the unions has been on the railroads? Has it been a positive impact over the years, or a negative impact?
It was a positive impact until they got power, and they started, the old guard that started the unions retired or died, and a new guard that hadn't gone through the trials and tribulations got into power, and they wanted to stay there. everybody was afraid of going to jail.
For sure.
The old time union men weren't afraid of going to jail. They weren't afraid of getting shot at. They didn't like it. They didn't ask for it. Sometimes they shot back. But they weren't afraid of it. It happened. When they went on strike, the judge could say, go back to work, you're going to go to jail. Hey, send us to jail. Harry Truman tried it with the steel and with railroads. It didn't work because the unions told him, throw us all in jail. We're willing to go. He backed down. There wasn't enough room in the jails. And fine? Fine who? Nobody has any money. Keep us in jail. That's what they told him then. Now, the judge says, go back to work or we're going to find your contempt or you're going to go to jail. Union leaders say, okay, we'll go back to work.
That's a good point.
Because they're afraid of losing their $100,000 a year jobs.
Back in the Depression, I'm backtracking a little bit here, but do you recall when the trains would slow down?
Yeah.
Like a coal train?
My father used to go.
Really?
Yeah. A lot of people used to go. I'd say half the population in the city of Girard and Youngstown did.
Really?
Yeah.
Get on the trains and throw the coal off?
Over Westlake's Crossing, yes?
Yeah.
Okay, now it was a heavy pull on the Erie Railroad from right out of the depot. Right to McKinley Heights. It was all uphill. Except for the leveling out spot at Briarhill. They would get on, hop on these trains, coal trains, coming up out of P&L or off to B&O. I'm just talking about the Erie, that's all I know about.
Mm-hmm.
And they get on at Westlake's Crossing. Perfect place to get on, nice little crossing, the train's going about 4 or 5 miles an hour as fast as it could go. And they would throw coal off at every road crossing between there and Niles. And they come along later, somebody come along later, pick it up. And that happened every time a coal train went by. I don't care what time of day or night, every time a coal train went by, that's it. They were on it.
How many people were we talking?
Oh, like I say, I would say 1/3 of the men in Girard, Ohio. We're talking maybe 3,000 men. Not every day of the week. They get enough to last a week and then go out. Again.
So, just going back, a train's going through Girard. How many men are on it throwing off train? Cool.
Well, I think the mostly all in those days. No, I didn't. This I going from way back. I would say you had a 50 car train. You had 50 men.
A guy for each car.
Yeah.
Did anybody ever get hurt?
Yeah. See, they throw off their pile, then get off. Then somebody get on and throw off their pile and get off. They didn't do it, you know, for everything, they did it for themselves. They threw off their own little pile where they could come and get it at night or later. There were times, and this is just what I heard from railroaders when I first started out in the railroad, that there were times when the coal going from West Virginia to the boats up in Cleveland to haul other places, that they start out 10,000 tons of coal, 3,000 tons of coal by the time we got to Cleveland. And that is...
Did the railroad, the police try to stop them?
Sure.
Not too successful?
No. We had one policeman for, what, 20 mile of track? It's even worse now. Oh, another thing about this. Big snow out in Chicago. I'm going to tell you about it. All these piggyback trains coming in from New York were loaded with high-class, expensive merchandise. The ones I had parked between 51st Street and Hammond, Indiana, I told you about, they were empty when they got in 51st Street yard and unloaded.
Empty?
Yes. Anything that was valuable was stolen from us.
People were out in the deep snow and...
Yep, they were out on skis, snowshoes, and... Well, they went right through one of the roughest parts of Chicago. But they were all empty. Anything of value in it was empty by the time it got unloaded in Chicago. That was unbelievable. Do you ever drive down a highway? Imagine this. I'm talking about a 12-lane expressway. I noticed this when I was going home after I was in the gun. I'm driving over the top of the highway that I normally took to work. And I think it was the Calumet Express. That part of it was called the Calumet Expressway. It was 12 lanes wide, 6 one way and 6 the other. There were cars, 12 lanes wide, parked bumper to bumper. 25 miles on that expressway. The snow stopped or started at the East End of Hammond Yard. And when all of them, East of Hammond was maybe a little bit of snow. But you can imagine. They were just parked bumper to bumper. I wish I had a camera to take the picture. That took after they finally got it going, started to get it cleaned up. That's how Mary Daly lost his job. It was because the town was tied up a bit in 2 weeks.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. It took 2 weeks after they finally got the equipment in there. Greg Barton stole it from anybody they could. Before they got the expressways clear of automobiles.
I can't imagine.
Well, we had a snow like that back here in 51. It snowed for 3 days. When it started to snow around Thanksgiving time, real light snow, just like in Chicago. We kept on snowing that way for 3 days.
I remember hearing about that from my parents.
Yeah, I went to work. I walked to work the first day. I was staying out in Gypsy Lane at my sister's place, watching the children. My wife and I were watching the children. My husband was in the hospital. And I walked down Belmont Avenue. The depot and got on a old passenger train coach. They took me to Briar Hill. And I was at Briar Hill for 3 days then. I worked 8 hours as a clerk, 8 hours as a yard master, 8 hours as a clerk, 8 hours. Of course, I was the only one there, but to get around the 16-hour law, that's how they showed me. 8 hours clerk, 8 hours yard master, 8 hours. I was there for 2 minutes. to, I got home on an Army half track. They took me and drove back down on the passenger train down to the depot and rode the National Guard out with half tracks.
Okay.
And they rode me up to E&P. Me and Jack Marshall, did Jack tell you about this?
Mm-mm.
Well, Jack and I, my wife and the two children and my sisters and our child were there out in the middle of nowhere with no food for 2.5 days. They couldn't get out of the place. So we stopped and got groceries. Jack Marshall, I'm pretty sure. My wife told me it was Jack that was with me. I knew there was somebody on the road with me. And we hauled groceries in for the AP. Welcome to Snow, everybody.
Incredible.
But it was fun. I was young then. Now it probably killed me. But I do. I love railroading. I love most of the people I worked with. They were fine people. Now, I don't want to get the wrong impression about the Penn Central people. 90% of them were good. But the bad ones at Penn Central were about 100 times worse than the bad ones at me. I don't want to remember. I mean, they were wacky. They reminded me of the wackos I had out in Chicago. Now, all the people out in Chicago weren't bad either. But the split was more even than I liked. Does it say 50-50, and I was on the side of the good guys. Oh, man. At least I thought I was on the side of the good guys. Oh, every time I tried to cut overtime or anything out there, they were on strike and the company back. You try that for 6 years. Get tired of it. I don't blame them because it was a going operation for them, even though they weren't making much money yet, because we didn't own it. We didn't own the land the yard was on, we leased it. We didn't own the land the piggy bank yard was on, we leased it. We didn't own the cars. We didn't own any of the trailers. We had to pay people to unload and load the trailers. And you can't make money that way when you're paying other people to do the work. Now the Penn Central, Pepsi, I think they own their own unloaders. Yeah. They own their own equipment. And they made a dollar. But our piggyback business out in Chicago was, when I first went out there, when I left, was 10 times the size of Penn Central operation. But I think they were making money.
No, it sounds like you enjoyed it anyway.
Overall, I enjoyed working with them. Every job has its moments for things I'm working. I didn't exactly enjoy some of the hours. But then again, it was fun. I never forget one time when I was working at Lovesburg. We had a train, we called 99, coming over the main track. And two cars of coffee in the middle of the train just jumped out. Landed down on State Route 5. And I walked that train 5 times trying to find where those two cars of coffee came out of the train. And I couldn't. Until finally I had the engineer on the engine turn the air back in. walked it. The train had, the two cars had jumped out, the train had coupled back up again, and the air hoses, I'm talking 2:30 in the morning and in the dark, no lights, the air hoses weren't together. They looked like they were together. And in other words, I didn't go in and test every air hose. He put the air back in and I walked along and I listened to him right in the middle of the hose up. But they looked like they were before I had the engine and put the air back in. That was very cold too. It happened before. But strange things happened on the river. And I kind of miss railroads being gone. The country's going to miss railroads being gone. You know that Conrail even, one thing I didn't like about Conrail is what they have themselves admitted they've done and they're trying to correct it. They get rid of business on purpose.
With small branch lines, you mean?
Yes, they shut them out on purpose. Denied them service. In fact, I got my rear end chewed out. The steel door out here called me up one day and asked me for some gondola. I said, sure, well, I couldn't tell you. 10 minutes later, I got a phone call from somebody downtown to ask me how come I promised those guys some gondolas. I said, we got gondolas coming out of our ass here. Oh, we don't have a crew to go up there. Okay, so I don't have a crew. What Conrail's doing, and what all the railroads, not only Conrail, is something that what railroads did when they first were made in this country. The major railroads only want to go from point A to point B, like Conrail. In other words, take a car from Conway to Chicago.
Just road haul.
With no stops in between. And then have all these little short lines. Do all the switching. But a mainline railroad cannot do that and survive in the long haul. Because out west, maybe, eastern railroad cannot do it. Because eastern railroads haul going west, haul more empties than anything else. Even when times were good on railroads, 2/3 of the westbound freight on any railroad, eastern railroad, northeastern railroad, north of the Mason-Dixon line, and east of the Mississippi, 2/3 of the westbound traffic was empty. You don't make money off of empties.
I've also heard that the eastern railroads are more terminal intensive. You know, there's a lot more stops between points on the eastern railroads. Crew change points, classification yards, where out west they'll just run for through an entire state without stopping, you know?
Well,
they just run out there.
In a way, the unions brought that on themselves by not adapting to the diesel. Well, I could see why, because of new losing jobs. They went by the whole 100-mile rule, which in the early steam engine days, or the steam engine days, which is not as far as a steam engine could run without stopping for coal or water or something. And they only went 15, 20 miles an hour, so 100 miles was $8 for the work. If you had run a diesel, you could run 300 or 400 miles. But you had to have work features. And the cuts started costing the railroads too much money, especially when the trucks became large type competition. We have to develop the interstate highway system. And it was only until, I'd say, the last 10, 15 years that the unions finally gave up on that. And by that time, they didn't have anything to fight for anymore. That's what happened to them. They want to give up on the firemen. Finally, they had to.
Now the board is they want to get down to a two-man crew on road jobs.
Well, there's a limit beyond which railroads better not go. All the electronic devices in the world fail. And if you've got train that is protected on the rear end by electronic devices, and you're running into and you're hauling hydrocyanic acid through the middle of town and somebody runs into it, and they derail and brake. Hasn't happened yet, but it will. I didn't know about this until after the war. It didn't happen when I was here. I was overseas when it happened. But up in Cleveland, Ohio, in the 40s, train derailed, carrying propane gas. And the gas started to leak. And somebody lit a match, or a spark of some kind. 1,100 people died. Propane gas, you see carbon dioxide when it comes out of a container, goes to the ground, that's how propane gas acts. And it just crept into sewers and houses, basements of houses, and the sparks set it off. Happy sight, from what I can understand. And also, this happened out of Chicago, or around Chicago, in one of the old towns around Chicago, in the 70s. When they didn't know how propane worked in those days, in the 40s, when it first happened. But they did know when this happened. This happened in a switching yard. I think the CNEI or somewhere right out in Chicago. Tank cars of propane derailed. And the drawbar of one went into the tank, and behind it or whatever, and the whole. Well, they were clearly Packarded propane and so on and so forth. And you shouldn't do anything about it until everybody, they didn't evacuate anybody, nothing. Some train master came in and called a crew and tied onto this tank car and stuck into the other tank car and pulled back, and sparks lit up and the whole yard blew up. That was in the newspapers. This happened in early 70s.
Yeah, this material is certainly a big topic right now, where they handle it.
Yeah, and people are getting up in arms about them being hauled on the expressways and the superhighways and so on and so forth. So more and more of it's going to, see, they started taking it and haul it on. Now it's going to all come back on the railroad sooner or later. And I only know when it happens, then they'll change it. They won't change anything until something happens. They never do. This country reacts. It doesn't act, it reacts. American business doesn't like to react.
Out of automobile industry found that out.
Yeah.
Well, that's one of the questions I have. Do you want to add anything else in?
Yeah, 19. Yeah. Did you have put that down there?
I'll put it on the phone. Okay.